Well, Zach, here we are at Tribe Fest as we record this over the weekend. This is the way that fans nowadays connect to the players of the current Indians organization. But in years past, Tribe Fest didn't always exist. In fact, there were other ways that fans were forced to connect to their ball players in ways...
Forced?
Well, depends on...
You're going to go in there and you're going to get Jim Thome's autograph whether you like it or not.
Depends on what you think of the word trade wreck and how you would describe certain things you might have witnessed in
this
the
podcast,
late 90s.
For one.
Before Tribe Fest, there was Tribe Jam.
Yes.
And for anybody that has followed along on The Athletic this week, you're now brought back up to speed on what the hell was Tribe Jam. Zach, you were all over this story from the jump. It was something you just had to write. And this story took you years to craft and put together.
Literally took multiple years. Started in 2018.
But it was a fun read, and I remember bits and pieces of that, and I wasn't there, but I remember seeing video of that in the late 90s, and I remember the stories of Jim Thome playing a guitar that wasn't plugged in. But you were able to separate the fact from the fiction and find out what actually happened at Tribe Jam.
So, I'll start from the beginning.
Also, welcome to a bonus edition of the Selby's Godcast.
Yeah. The funniest part about this, and again, if you haven't read On The Athletic, go check it out. Two-part series. One on Tribe Jam, and the second part on a cool friendship between Omar Vizquel and Paul Sidoti, Taylor Swift's guitarist and a local Clevelander or native Clevelander. And just kind of all the ties between the 90s Indians and music. I wasn't planning to write this. I went down to North Carolina to hang out with Omar Vizquel for a day to write a story about him and about his managing pursuits and why the hell this 51-year-old accomplished veteran of Major League Baseball who played for a quarter of a century and wants to manage is managing 19-year-olds in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We were talking in his office that day about how, you know, when he was in Cleveland, it was so important for him a couple things. One, to be part of like the fabric of the community and to go out and be seen and to do things and to stay busy and to just do things that just captivate his attention. And so he would go to bars and he would look for live music and he would go to art shows and he would go to comedy clubs. And first of all, I feel like you don't really see that too much anymore. Like, I don't know that Francisco Lindor is going out and, I don't know, listening to a lounge singer at Johnny's downtown.
I don't even know how much you just see players connect to the local community.
Yeah.
Like you used to. Players now have so much to do in the off season, and it's basically don't have an off season that they're all over the place.
Right. And I knew 2 years ago in September when the Tigers played in Cleveland and Omar Vizquel was the first base coach, he went out after a Friday night game to Wild Eagle Saloon down the street from the ballpark, and his buddy Paul Sidoti, he had a local cover band and they were playing a bunch of 80s hits, and him and Omar have been friends for 20 years. And Omar gets on stage, and like he used to do in the 90s, he performed Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne. And like there were 200 people at the bar, and they've all got their iPhones out, and they're recording it, and they're like having a great time. And so I asked Omar, like, do you still do that kind of thing here? Like in Winston-Salem, you don't know the area. It's not like there's... You know, you don't hear people say, oh, have you checked out Winston-Salem's like bar scene and live music? Like, it's not that kind of place. But he'll do whatever he can to find that sort of scene. And it led down this path to, we started talking about Tribe Jam and just what he used to do in the 90s. And I Googled really quick something about Tribe Jam and found this like photo album. And he's scrolling through and just laughing hysterically, like, I can't believe just how foolish we looked, but it was so much fun, and it was the fans loved it. And it was like, you know, we talk about how the 90s Indians were rock stars. They literally were here, where you had Omar on stage, Jim Thome on stage, Richie Sexson, Mark Langston, who 99 was his only season with the Indians. It was his last season in the majors. he had all these music connections because he liked to play guitar. And when he was in Seattle, he got to be friends with Eddie Money. He got to be friends with the drummer from the band Yes. He got to be friends with a local band out there called Magic Bus, who served as the house band for the first Tribe Jam concert. And this all came together so quickly. It came together more quickly than it took me to write the story. But in a matter of like a month or so, you went from Paul Sidoti befriending Omar Vizquel and Mark Langston and Richie Sexson to having Tribe Jam. And next thing you know, like, Michael Stanley's involved. And so it was, first of all, the process of writing the story was so much fun because even though it was 20 years ago, like, these guys remember. Dave Burba remembered the song he performed each year. First year it was Brick House, and he's like, he was like a lunatic screaming on stage. The second year, it was Walk This Way by Aerosmith. And then the third year, he did Ice Cream Man by Van Halen, and he was dressed like an ice cream vendor, came through the crowd, people were tipping him. Like, those guys had so much fun. You could never pull this off today, which sucks, because I've said the Indians should do this. They're hosting the All-Star Game. It'd be so much fun if you had, like, Lindor on stage and Ramirez and Tito. But just, like, you...
What musical instrument would Tito be playing?
I mean, the freaking Burba and Tommy shook maracas. Like, Omar played the tambourine at one point. They had a cowbell.
I could see Tito with the triangle.
Yeah, like, or the cowbell. Ding, 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 ding. But it was really cool, and the funny part was, one, talking to all the players and getting their recollections of it, and then I got my hands on a video copy of the first concert, and seeing, like, Tommy was like, yeah, it was fun. My guitar was unplugged, so it took some of the nerves away, but, like, yeah, had a good time. And then seeing the video and seeing how awkward Tommy looked and how dorky he looked, it was unbelievable. And then I'll just remember Michael Stanley saying, when I told him, I'm like, yeah, I've got the video of this. I'm going to go watch it later today. And he's like, oh, shit, you better take your meds before watching that. And I'm like, it was really, really cool. And I just, you don't see that kind of thing anymore.
Yeah, the stories that I remember from it were fun to kind of relive as you were piecing it together. And ultimately, I got to read your story. The one quote that stuck with me, though, was Bob DiBiasio of the Indians.
Yeah.
When he said that they could have held a game in a parking lot of a Kmart, was that
Giant,
what he said?
Giant Eagle.
Giant Eagle. And it really did feel that way. You know, just the state of the city, the Browns ultimately leaving, the team being good, the personalities that they had, it all came together in such a way that, yeah, there was that feeling. The fans would have got together to see the Indians do just about anything and would have loved the hell out of it. But the fact that it was music, it always comes back to that thought that athletes want to be musicians, yep. Musicians want to be actors, actors want to be athletes. It, yeah. It's like this endless loop of, if you're in that realm, everybody would love to try their hand at doing something different. And some of the guys that had the musical talent, it's fantastic to watch and look back on.
Omar was so good on the drums.
But it's even better to see guys who don't necessarily have a ton of skill, but just are up having fun with it, because that's seeing somebody having fun like that as someone that's just watching it. Even if it's not a great musical performance, it's going to go down in history for the musical art of it. Just the enjoyment of seeing guys go out there and not give a shit whether or not they're going to look good or not. That was fun. And that was cool to relive.
I missed that. I think that's part of what makes... That's what made... Like, the personalities in baseball. We were just talking about this with Ryan Lewis about how, you know, 20 years ago...
How things were always better back in the day.
Yeah, but you would get up early to watch This Week in Baseball because they would have cool interviews with players on the field, and you get to glean those personalities. And now guys are afraid to make fools of themselves. And I remember Sandy Alomar was one of the guys, him and Nagy and Paul Shuey, who kind of stood off to the side and drank beer and watched and laughed at their teammates. He said he didn't want to make a fool out of himself. Dave Burba said, shit, I didn't care. Like, I got out there. He stuck a maraca down his pants and twerked. I mean, that says it all. And I'm not saying you need Lindor and Kluber to do that, but, man, it would just be – imagine if you could just see those personalities shine on stage and have... Baseball has such a hard time marketing its players and connecting them to the casual fan. And this was like the perfect way to do that. I mean, it was Michael Stanley got up on stage and was saying how he would have traded in his guitar for an infielder's glove. He loved baseball so much. He would have wished he could have been a utility infielder. And then you got Omar, who's like, man, I wish I could be a rock star. It really is the perfect match.
Yeah, it was fun to read. I'm glad that you got to tell that story, because it's one that maybe some people weren't even aware of that it happened. But very cool to see some of those personalities come together and to see what people remember and what stood out and maybe what wasn't remembered and some of the things forgotten for various reasons. But I don't know, was there anything that really stood out to you as far as something you didn't know or didn't anticipate going in that really floored you or surprised you or even just made you laugh?
Yeah, a couple things. One, during that first Tribe Jam concert, Jim Tomey had a bat, and he used the bat and he like pretended to hit. They had like a Liberty Bell replica. He swung the bat at the bell, and that's how they like started Hell's Bells. And then a few minutes later, he brought the bat back out, and this balloon that had New York written on the side, and it was a black balloon. They were playing the Yankees that weekend, so I think that was the impetus. But also, you know, the Indians and Yankees they had a nice rivalry going in the late 90s, and Tomey swung the bat, hit the balloon, confetti spread all across the stage, and the lead singer of the house band just yells, "Yeah! That's what you guys are going to do to New York!" It was 99, and 2 weeks later, they blew a 2-0 lead in the ALDS, and the Red Sox advanced to face the Yankees instead. But there was just so much camaraderie and so much. Obviously, the Indians owned the city. It was crazy because it was like 2 weeks after the Browns came back. But obviously, you knew the Browns weren't going to be good for a while, and the Indians just ran the town and just they really were rock stars at that time, and especially the guys who were here for a while, Omar, Tomey. It was cool talking to Tomey too. It sounded like he was timid talking about it, because I think he enjoyed it and it was cool. But like,
he understood that that wasn't his scene.
Yeah, and they made him like, especially in the later years, he was the star, and they put funky sunglasses on him and gave him an electric guitar that wasn't plugged in, and he sang "I Got You, Babe" by Sonny and Cher with one of the members of Michael Stanley's band.
So walk us through, how did the guitar get smashed?
It was on I don't remember the song. I can't remember. It was the last year, and you know, he was not that he was hesitant to do it, but he was like, you're right, he was out of his element, and they had to assure him, and they were like, I know one person said, they were like, dude, just go on stage. You're fucking Jim Tomey. Like, just hold this guitar, pretend like you're having fun, and the people are going to eat it up. And
he's just not one to want to be, look at me. Spotlight's got to be on me. That's never been his personality.
So the last year, they were like, why don't you smash a guitar? Because that's what rockers do, and it could be fun. So he smashed it. It didn't, like, it's not like he shattered the thing. It's like there's like a little, not a little, a slice missing off the end of it. But he, you know, David Spiro, who is one of the people, he managed Michael Stanley for a while, and Joe Walsh of the Eagles, he worked with Ringo Starr for a long time, a prominent native Clevelander who still lives here and has worked with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for a long time. So he was in on this and helped plan it every year. And so Tomey signed the guitar after that concert, and I know Spiro still has it in his office in Cleveland. So it had run its course after 3 years. The roster changed. They started their rebuild in 2002. And I think they made a good decision ending it. But those 3 years, I know it was a big hit. It raised a lot of money for charity.
Something isn't special because it lasts.
Right.
I believe that is what Vision said at the end of Avengers Age of Ultron, one of your favorite movies of all time.
I also think, you know, an eye-opening thing was getting to know Omar who's just got this boundless energy about him, even at 51 years old. It's incredible. But TJ, I know, like, you were with me when we heard some of these stories about him, and just like him and Robbie Alomar, there's been a lot of stories about how they didn't necessarily get along and love each other. But, like, that's rare. If you've been around Omar for 2 minutes, that energy is infectious. He's a thoughtful guy. He has turned heads. He's going to be managing a Double-A this year. He's moving up the system. I know he wants to manage in the major leagues, and he's, like, what he did last year with some of the White Sox prospects, I know they were raving about it. He is, like, you want him in your clubhouse. You wanted him in your clubhouse back then. You want him now. And it's like some of the stories, remember Matt Williams had just gone through his divorce when he came to Cleveland and was going through a rough time. And he had the kids one weekend early in the season. And the Indians wanted to, like, do something nice for him because he was, you know, it was a struggle, and they wanted to take his mind off things and treat his kids to a nice weekend in Cleveland. So the Indians had a connection at Swings and Things, mm-hmm. on the west side, and they got the owner to open the shop a couple hours early, and Matt Williams is going to take his kids there. And just, like, here you go. You have the run of the town. Just play putt-putt, play video games, do whatever you want for a couple hours. And Omar overheard this whole conversation happening, and he goes to the Indians rep, and he says, hey, like, let me bring my kid, Nico, and I'll go too. And that way Matt Williams doesn't have to be by himself. And I can get a couple other players who have little kids. And that way it can be like a team bonding thing. And these kids can play together and it'll be great. And, like, that was just one of the stories. And there are many of just, he was a really good teammate and a really good glue guy in a clubhouse full of big personalities. You got guys like Kenny Lofton and Albert Bell and Manny Ramirez. And he was an important figure.
Yeah. Maybe not Jose Mesa. Probably doesn't believe some of the things that you just said.
Yeah, true.
But you're right. And that was a very cool story that we heard as far as him and connecting with Matt Williams in a tough time. I'm kind of not upset. I don't even know if I'm sad. But the way that his name has become very volatile when it comes to Hall of Fame discussions.
Yeah.
Where people are just going to war over how good of a player he was, how good defensively he was. I don't think the debate is as easy and as one-sided as those that are as firmly against him being in the Hall of Fame have made it sound and make you believe. I don't know that I would consider him a Hall of Famer. I'm still hesitant to say that I do. Having watched him play a lot of his career in Cleveland, I can say that I don't think, for as much as I believe in defensive metrics and believe in numbers, I don't think everything he did was wrapped up in those.
Yeah.
I also think it's really, really difficult to make a Hall of Fame case, especially when talking about players that played 20, 25 years ago, based solely on defensive statistics, because you just don't have a perfect way of, you know, there's so much noise year to year and the way things are tracked. Even today, with having guys basically on radar 24/7, you don't have the most clear-cut perfect picture at all times of a guy playing defense. And Omar, you're looking at his Hall of Fame case just basing it specifically on defense. That's extremely difficult. But I guess I'm, and I don't know if this bothers him. Maybe you can shed some light on this. But I find it disheartening that there are some that almost, and I know this is not their intent, because you get wrapped up in this, like when you're talking about NFL draft picks, like one guy likes one quarterback, one guy likes another quarterback, doesn't mean that you think the other guy's trash, you just like the other guy more. I'm not sure that the conversation really is to make Omar Vizquel sound like he was a bad defensive player, but some of the arguments make it sound like, you know, he wasn't all that good. And I think it's a more difficult conversation than some have made it seem.
Let me ask you this. He played 24 years in the majors.
Yeah.
Do you hold that against him? It almost seems like people do.
I go back and forth on this because there was a time where I'm like, okay, yeah, you're just accumulating stats. That's not as good as someone that can do it over a shorter period of time. But the fact that you can stick around playing what is supposed to be the most difficult defensive position, I mean, outside of catcher, but just the most difficult defensive position for an older guy to go out there and play, and for teams to continue to employ you and to give you the opportunity for you to go out and stay on the field, there's something to be said for that, for sticking around that long.
Teams thought he was valuable enough to be an asset at the age of 44, 45.
Right.
So I don't know if that's Hall of Fame worthy, but some people seem to hold that against him, and I know it makes his numbers look not as good.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know if you should hold that against him or not. If you're sticking around and people continue to give you a job, and I mean, shouldn't that be impressive? Shouldn't the fact that you continue to hold down a major league job where there's plenty of other capable 21, 22, 23-year-olds that would love to have it and you know, would maybe even be comparable to what you're doing out there, teams value your contributions more? I don't know if it should be a negative.
Yeah, so I asked him about this, and I'll be writing about it for The Athletic at some point soon here. He doesn't give it too much thought.
I can see that being the case.
It's out of his control. He's got enough going on in his life. He stays so busy that, you know, he's not going to sit there and read the clips and see what people are saying about his candidacy. He did bring up an interesting point, though. He said, the thing I'm most proud about is that you see a lot of guys, especially now, and free agency plays into this, but you don't see too many people still playing at 37, 38 years old, especially a position. A DH, Nelson Cruz, Mike Napoli, sure. But do you see many 37, 38-year-olds out there in the field?
Not playing.
He won a gold glove at 39 playing shortstop. And I know gold glove awards are, especially they used to be, very arbitrary. And, you know, Rafael Palmeiro won a gold glove at first base and he played like 20 games there. But he was very proud of the fact that
those were an amazing 20 games.
His counterparts were all retiring at 36, 37, and he's still out there winning gold gloves. And, you know, it speaks to his, he was always so nimble, so agile. He stayed in such great shape. It was funny, when I was meeting with him, when I walked into his office, he was shirtless. And he started telling me about how he's getting fat. And I'm like, this dude is like, he's still got like a six pack. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then he was eating this meal from Publix, and he was eating this, he grabbed this bowl of mac and cheese and he accidentally dropped it on the floor. And he yelled at me and he's like, I was too busy talking to you. You made me drop my mac and cheese. You owe me a new mac and cheese. And I was like, well, you said you were getting fat. So he looks like he could still play. But and I do think, I don't know if he's a Hall of Famer. I've tried to not think about who I would vote for if I had a vote. And I'm still a few years away just because I don't want to start thinking in certain methods. And then I get a vote and I'm kind of pigeonholed into that. I don't know how I'm going to feel about it when
and
I do a vote.
And it's easy to now because there's been such a backlog of guys that I think are deserving.
Yeah.
And you only have 10 votes and not everyone even utilizes all 10. You're seeing, I think, a shift in that. You're seeing more people be open. And to be honest, I'm probably more in favor of a bigger hall as opposed to a smaller one.
Me too.
I think
it's
you
a
should
museum.
Just,
I'm
you
kidding.
Should remember the players that had a huge impact on the game in a lot of different ways, and sometimes positively and negatively. You can't just ignore certain things, certain aspects, or certain eras,
sure,
because it might have given your sport a black eye at the time. It's still part of your history, and I think you should celebrate it for what it was for and not necessarily condone everything that happened, but just this is what happened in our game. This is part of our history, and that's why I think voting 10 guys every year should be the standard, and I think that's also stupid. You should have as many votes as you think are guys deserving to be in the Hall of Fame. All that said, there are so many guys that are deserving right now that I think are ahead of Omar that it's easy for me to say I wouldn't vote for him right now because I can find 10 more worthy candidates. It's not as simple as yes or no, but I think that should be the standard. It should just be a yes or no vote. Is this guy Hall of Fame worthy or not?
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to be relegated to just 10 votes. And that's
Let's also take a minute to say Kenny Lofton deserved a much better fate than he received when he got less than 5% in his first year and then was kicked off the ballot.
Yeah, that was perplexing. And every year we kind of look at that. Especially when you see the career that, that Tim Raines had.
And that's what I was going to bring up, is that we... I'm glad Tim Raines was rewarded for his longevity. But then Kenny Lofton, their numbers were comparable.
Maybe Lofton's were slightly better. How much do you think it hurts Lofton because...
His timing,
the last half of his career, he was on almost a different team every year.
Yeah.
And some people will view that as a negative. Well, he never stuck around more than one place for very long. You could also look at that as a lot of contenders every single year were targeting
absolutely.
Him and wanted him on their team.
He made the playoffs. He had a crazy streak there. And you would also think that he played in enough cities where all the voters got to see him up close.
Yeah.
You would have thought that would have helped him. But he had bad timing. I think he was on the year, the first year, he was on the ballot the first year that, like, all those guys, Bonds, Clemens, Sosa, joined the ballot, and that hurt him. But, you know, if Harold Baines can get elected via the
Veterans Committee,
then Kenny Lofton should absolutely someday, too.
It's even if you don't make a decision yes or no on Lofton, he should have stuck around a lot longer than just where he was on the ballot for 1 year. That was an embarrassment to the voting process that I think really needs to be overhauled. And I already don't like the way that it's become almost political in the way people utilize their votes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's their vote. You know, they've got their vote. They can use it how they want. And that's the system that's been in place. I wish the system would change, but this is what it is right now.
Well, you're a Hall of Famer in my book.
Thank you, man. I only have like 9 years to go or something until.
It's not all it's cracked up to be, I've heard.
Yeah.
Do you want to do a random Indian?
Haven't we spoken about enough random Indians? Mark Langston.
Langston. I will say.
Dave Burpa.
The story of how they all.
Richie Sexton.
Became friends with Paul Sidoti, who is Taylor Swift's guitarist. He was a Strongsville grad, Ohio State grad. Played locally at bars all over the place in the 90s and the aughts. And, I think that's cool. He's maintained friendships with Langston and Vizquel for almost 20 years now. And it goes back to athletes want to be musicians and musicians want to be athletes.
Well, you ought to find an athlete so we can do this random Indian of the day and get out of here for this week.
So this random Indian is... who should I go with? Oh, there's a couple really good ones. All right. This random Indian was born on August 7th, 1967. He played 15 years in the majors. Wow. Played for the Indians from 93 to 95.
Okay.
Pitcher. 39 appearances with the Indians, 21 starts, 18 out of the bullpen, 5.09 ERA.
Mark Clark.
No. Signed as a free agent with them in 93. They traded him before the 96 season to the California Angels for Brian Anderson.
Oh, I should know this.
His middle name is Allen.
I want to say Allen. Lefty?
Nope.
No? I think he was a lefty.
Do you want to know the other teams he pitched for? Phillies, Yankees, Royals, Orioles, Diamondbacks.
God, I know this too. The minute you tell me, I'm going to be so upset.
I can give you one more clue, but it's going to give it away.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Oh, it's... Jason Grimsley?
Yes. And my clue was going to be...
That he had a love of dropping in through ceiling tiles?
Yeah, he was the one who... went and retrieved Albert Bell's corked bat from the umpire's room and replaced it with
Paul Sorrento's bat.
How will they know the difference? no pitcher has ever been more experienced at climbing through the air vents and disposing of ceiling tiles.
All right, well, hope everyone enjoyed the bonus episode this week of the Selby is Godcast. And we thank all of you that have subscribed to the podcast, given us 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and have subscribed elsewhere, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Anchor, Podbean, Overcast, Pocket Cast.
You're just making these up now.
I'm just trying to remember to go off the top of my head. There is a bunch more, but thank you to everyone that has subscribed, and shout out to you for writing some terrific stories this week, and pleasure to help you recap it here on the podcast.
I appreciate that. We have a lot of cool stuff coming up too. I mean, it's crazy. Spring training around the corner now. And instead of just sitting here and talking about what are they going to do, what are they not going to do, and now we can actually look ahead.
Are you sure?
I think.
I don't know. We'll see when these jerks actually decide to sign anybody. And I'm talking about the entirety of the sport. We're out of here. Have a good weekend, everybody. See ya.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.